Every surfer that anybody knows has a dream of sailing off in the sunset with a beautiful woman and a bunch of money.
And that's what Chris and his family thought he was doing. But they couldn't have been more wrong.
Why hasn't he called?
He's skipped town. What would make him turn away from all the things he held so dear?
There's pirates in the water, so I was terrified.
Why hasn't he sent us any pictures?
Chris Smith is realizing day by day that Ed Shin, his partner, is a crook.
With a straight face, he would look you in the eye and be stealing from you.
Show me the truth. Show me the truth.
Ed Shin had two lives, his church, and then it turns out he had a real love of gambling, loved to go to Las Vegas.
Ed was the perfect Jekyll and Hyde.
Gambling a lot of money, seeing hookers.
It's like two worlds about to collide. It was helter skelter.
Ed, I need you to be honest.
Show me the truth.
Now's the time for you to tell me.
Show me the truth.
You get one shot at it.
I'm sorry, I just need a second.
This is a crime to remember. Was broken apart, won't go back together.
Chris Smith was a real surfer. He dedicated his life to this. And he loved it.
Chris was tall, dark, and handsome. The women were drawn to him. Very all-American surfer slash business casual professional guy.
Chris grew up in Watsonville, California, which is outside of the beach town Santa Cruz. It was a place where he got really into things like wakeboarding and surfing, a good place for a guy who was athletic and liked to do stuff outdoors.
I don't know many brothers that were as close as we were. We just had a unique bond. Ever since I was really little, he felt like he was there to protect me, to provide for me.
Were he and Paul always as close as they were towards, you know, in their later
always.
Years?
Always.
Always. They're just the best of friends.
We had just a great childhood. You know, my dad was a firefighter. My mom was a preschool teacher. We lived on a private ski lake. So we grew up water skiing, wakeboarding.
Chris wasn't a gifted student. He was dyslexic, but devilishly smart. Where he really excelled was in sports, and especially water sports.
Chris was almost like an adrenaline junkie. He had more of a drive than anybody else out on the lake.
Chris was known for his audacious tricks. He would try things that other people just thought were simply too dangerous. And it was doing one of those tricks that he blew out his Achilles tendon, and that was it for his pro wakeboarding career.
The water was his source of relief. Loved to surf, loved to be at the beach.
He was a lot of fun. I felt like he was always the life of the party. Like, people just gravitated towards him. He was always full of adventure.
If you think about Chris Smith, you gotta remember, he loved the ocean, loved action, loved beautiful cars. So he had that sort of quest for adrenaline. He liked that, thrived on that.
Outwardly, he was the jock, the surfer, the extreme sports guy. He looked the part, he just sort of fit that stereotype of the beach guy. But his friends say that he always had ambitions, he had plans.
He was very passionate about what he did, but he was very interested in being successful and making money. He wanted it all.
His dreams involved, you know, having a good amount of cash. And so he was striving for to be able to travel the world, to be very successful in business.
Chris Smith is doing great. He's living in Orange County. He's got an apartment in Laguna Beach. Orange County attracts very wealthy people. Rich people, famous people, just south of Los Angeles, a lot of the movie stars, a lot of the famous athletes wind up moving to Orange County, particularly in the area that Chris lived in. Beautiful houses, beautiful boats, beautiful cars, all of that. He's driving a Range Rover, he's surfing whenever he wants. He's encountered great business success in the lead generation business.
Debt 10,000 offers services to get you out of debt fast.
Chris becomes involved in this extremely lucrative part of the advertising and marketing industry that sells sales leads from people calling into 800 numbers. And he teams up with a man named Ed Shin, another young, promising entrepreneur. And together, they form a company called the 800 Exchange.
800 Exchange got to be very successful. They reached a point where they were making millions of dollars.
After years of that free-spirited beach guy lifestyle of chasing waves and beautiful women, well, guess what happens? Chris meets perhaps the one, a wonderful woman named Erica, and she seemed to fill every void when it came to romance.
Tell me about his girlfriend, Erica.
She was sweet. Yeah, I was looking forward to having her as a sister-in-law.
Did it seem like it was serious?
Yeah, I could tell that he really liked her. And he had expressed to me that, you know, he was thinking about getting even more serious in terms of proposing to her, so I knew he really liked her.
She had said then she just loved him so much, and he had told his father he loved her.
Did you think that, you know, he may propose?
We did.
Yeah,
we thought he was
really
talking about it.
You know, if you looked at Chris from the outside, you would see this hunky guy living in beautiful Southern California who has this incredibly lucrative job, this beautiful ballet dancer with dazzling green eyes as a girlfriend, and you think he has it all. But there were signs of stress. The company that he had founded with Ed Shin, it starts to look like it could be in jeopardy.
Chris was always talking to his friends about, hey, we should go, we should quit all this. He had visions of these faraway places and that he could live a simpler life there.
If you knew Chris, you would know about how he believed in conspiracy theories and certain things. He was like anti-government and taxes, like we shouldn't pay taxes, that kind of thing.
He wanted to make it big so that he could cut out. He was quite dissatisfied in many ways with the modern world.
And it looks like 31-year-old Chris Smith
finally makes the decision to do just that, sever all ties and just get off the grid. Chris emails his family telling them that he and Ed met and they reached an agreement. Ed had bought him out of his share of the company they founded, 800 Exchange.
Everyone knew that Chris was a free spirit and that he wanted adventure. But it was a little bit surprising when suddenly, unannounced, they find out through emails that Chris is off the grid. He's leased a yacht. He's gone on a world-traveling adventure. But nobody knew about it until they got these sudden emails.
Monday, June 7th, 2010. I'm going on a vacation. Probably 3-week trip to Galapagos Islands in Costa Rica. Love you, too.
It made total sense to you that Chris would just up and leave it all.
Yeah. I remember him in the kitchen saying, I'm so over all of it. I'm just going to be done. I'm going to go be a bartender on the beach.
Amazing sailing for the past 2 weeks. There's no internet or phones, just us and the sea.
Every surfer has this dream of sailing off into the sunset with a bunch of money and a beautiful woman. In this case, the problem is it was not Erica.
Chris sends Paul an email, and attached to it is a picture of his traveling companion, and she is stunning. She's a former Playboy playmate, Tiffany Taylor.
This may seem like Chris's dream trip, but it's nothing but a nightmare for Erica. So through a message from Chris, she learns she's been tossed overboard.
You know, most people would be like, a Playboy playmate? Come on. But Chris was good-looking enough, wealthy enough, that actually made total sense.
Yep.
I remember I got one email from Erica, and she was like really mad, and she said, what the, you know, what's going on, you know, is he bipolar? And I said, well, no, you know, sometimes he just needed to get away.
There's only my friend and me and the crew. I miss you guys too. I see things so much more clearly now because I've unplugged myself of that crazy society and fast lane, something I should have done so much sooner.
Basically saying, I'm headed to Peru, I'm gonna travel a bit. And I remember saying, wow, I love you. take pics, you know, have a great time.
I'll be home probably around early to mid-August. I want to get up to Buenos Aires if possible. The seas are choppy, sometimes smooth.
At first, Chris said that this trip would last a couple of weeks. Those weeks turn into months, and suddenly he's on this sort of round-the-world epic adventure.
Hey, guys. I just finally docked in Ushuaia, a port in Argentina. You have about 20 to 25 more islands to explore. And
the question as these emails develop are, is he running to something or is he running away from something? Because as time went on, originally it looked like he just needed a break. And then the emails started to look like he might have been running from something.
Show me the truth. Show me the truth.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 Central on ABC.
Chris has dropped off the grid and he has taken off to this wonderful surf trip with a beautiful woman. He's got no phone, he's got no camera, and they're only getting periodic emails regarding what he's doing. And as time goes on, the emails take a downright sinister turn.
Chris is emailing, you know, stuff about, you know, not wanting to come back. You know, just paint a picture that he was kind of losing sight of who he was.
His messages are not the kinds of things you'd really expect. So they're just, they're wondering, what is going on?
Show me the truth.
This past year and a half was such a nightmare for me. And I even contemplated doing unspeakable things because I was so stressed, angry, scared, and confused.
At that point, it was just, this isn't making any sense. This guy, he's lost his mind, you know?
Chris's family didn't know what to think because he seemed so up in some of his emails, and then he talks about even contemplating suicide.
Yeah, we were replying the best way we could to comfort him, to reassure him, do anything we could.
Yeah, they were super worried.
I don't know if I'll ever get over some of the things in my life, but this traveling and living on a sustenance level has really started to change how I see things and what matters to me. I'm actually journaling now, and one day I'll share some of the things I wrote down about our relationship growing up and happened within our family.
This disclosure about problems that Chris said that he experienced as a kid, this comes out of nowhere for the family. As far as they knew, he'd never experienced any emotional trauma.
That was strange to me, because we had a good relationship. There was, what he was saying wasn't true.
It was just like someone, you know, that was just very conflicted. And so that's when it got really alarming to my parents, you know, and they started getting emails like that about my brother's past and childhood. And we started to have suspicions, but didn't want to entertain that train of thought too much because of where it would lead to. I think it was so emotionally hard to even think about.
Chris has been gone for several months now, and his emails reflect a lot of mood changes, erratic behavior almost. So in the beginning, he's very happy. Then he reveals that he's very depressed, considering the unthinkable. Then he goes back to feeling very happy and adventurous once again. According to his emails, Chris has now ditched the playmate and he's on his own.
As time goes on, the family gets increasingly worried and they begin to wonder, are there some clues that we've missed?
What would make him turn away from all the things he held so dear? So naturally, it makes sense that they want to talk to his old business partner, Ed Chin. What might he know?
Ed Chin was the son of immigrants and he grew up in a conservative Christian home. And they demanded achievement from him and that's what he delivered. He was a really good student. He was a good athlete. Pretty much everything he did well. And eventually, he goes to UC San Diego.
On paper, Ed Chin was more naturally set up for success. Chris struggled in school. He didn't make it through college. Ed was doing all the right things, getting his degree, getting his first jobs. He had sort of the more obvious path to becoming successful in business. Ed Chin was an upstanding member of his community. He was a married father of three. He was the member of a Christian megachurch and was religious, dressed very nicely. He just looked the part of the successful business and family man.
Ed and his wife were members of our church here in Temecula, California.
Joseph Gray, who's actually run successful companies, and he's a completely legitimate businessman. And he meets Chin in this church group Bible study.
I thought he had some skills that ironically were in the vein of what we were looking for as we were starting a new company called Lead Generation Technologies.
Listen up, America.
Have you been denied credit?
Lead generation, if you hear this ad that says, reduce your credit card debt, get a new mortgage, and they tell you an 800 number at the end of it. You call in, they take down your information, and then they actually sell that off to companies that are in the mortgage business or in the credit card business.
A few examples up here.
The Tax 10,000 Network has helped people all over America.
Call 800-2.
So it's really just a way of grabbing customers and selling them off to the highest bidder.
So call us now.
So the more phone calls that are generated by these television ads, the more money your company gets.
So this is how Google makes most of its revenue today. They sell clicks online.
Right.
We're selling phone calls.
So Chin is hired by Joseph Gray. Joseph Gray gives him a job, and it's a position of trust.
What I really needed was somebody to go out there and develop a marketplace for the leads that we would be generating off of our television advertising. And I felt he could be employee number one. We gave him that kind of title.
In early 2008, Ed and Chris, who are both working in the lead generation industry, meet each other and hit it off.
And Ed recommended to Joseph that this guy Chris would be, he's a promising up-and-comer. I think we should bring him on board at LG Technologies.
On the sales side, Chris would have been employee number two, but I would say that at that moment, Ed and Chris were kind of the face of the company. So I was optimistic. The guys seemed to know what they were doing. It seemed like they were executing and we were growing.
Now, the key to building a successful lead generation company is finding buyers that are willing to pay big money for those leads, those calls that come into the 800 number. To find those buyers, there is no better place, perhaps on earth, than the convention circuit in Las Vegas. And that's where Ed goes to try to rustle up these buyers. While Chris is back at LG Technologies, Ed is trying to entice these new clients with parties and booze and women. Along for the ride in one of these incredibly lavish junkets to Las Vegas is one of Joe Gray's most trusted employees. He's an ex-Marine called Michael Montgomery.
So we landed in Vegas. We get picked up by the Phantom Fury Rolls Royce that was part of the Wynn. They pull us up to the entry of the Wynn. The suite was bigger than any room I've ever seen. Three bedrooms. It had a massage room, its own dining room.
Just picture this, one of the nicest hotels in Las Vegas. It is a two-story suite with butler service, its own billiard room, and an elevator.
Ed would hire what are known as atmosphere models or arm candy models, and these are beautiful women in Las Vegas who, for a fee, will come and hang out at your party. So it would just look like, to Ed's associates, like, this guy's the coolest guy in town. Because, look, he shows up, and suddenly these women flock to him.
My early impressions of Ed were he seemed very charming. But then there were sides of him that I really started to see that were not so charming.
Ed Shin had two lives. He's got his church-going, upstanding community member life in Orange County. And then it turns out he had a real love of gambling. And he was the type of player who could win or lose $100,000 in the space of a couple hours.
I come down and I'm walking through the casino floor and I saw Ed sitting right at the blackjack table. I would suspect that he had about $20,000 worth of chips sitting at the table there.
Ed Shin is gambling so much money in Vegas that they comp him that suite.
I heard crazy stuff like that. I felt, based on the relationship that we developed, things I had done for him personally, I felt that there would be some measure of loyalty. That Ed might be one of the last people that would take advantage of my generosity and kindness. But it all boiled down to one salient point in my mind. Ed was living beyond his means. I think I spent the next week working from my home, trying to figure out what's going on here, because we knew there was some fraud that had taken place. I think it was at that moment that I realized, oh boy, we've got a big problem. I learned we've been bamboozled here.
Ed was embezzling the money out of LG Tech.
At the same time that Ed was supposedly being the president of LG Technologies, looking out for that company's interests, he had formed a rival company doing more or less the same thing.
Ed and Chris have launched their own company, 800 Exchange. Ed Shin had embezzled a lot of money from Joe and stole clients. In this partnership between Chris and Ed, Chris has just under 50% stake.
And while this is a fresh start with a brand new company, Ed is still up to his old tricks. So at home, he's this model husband and family man. On the road, he's a high-stakes gambler and a womanizer.
800 Exchange was by far the biggest opportunity that Chris had had.
They were generating 1,500 phone calls a day. They were making money hand over fist. These were the heady days of making money, and they were killing it.
And given what you just said, it sounds like the vast majority of that was profit.
About 80% of it was profit.
When the business took off, Chris's circumstances were transformed. He was putting down roots. It just seemed like that thing he'd been reaching for so long was finally there for him.
He bought, along with Ed, a bunch of gold coins.
In 2009, Chris Smith starts increasing his stockpile of gold, and his favorite form of gold is this. It's called a Krugerrand. It's minted by the South African government, and in 2009, an ounce of one of these is worth about $1,000, and it's very popular among people like Chris Smith who don't trust banks or governments.
How much gold did Chris have?
I don't know the full amount, but it was tens of thousands of dollars that he stored in his condo.
While Ed and Chris are trying to get this company off the ground, Ed is living the high life. The finest suits, the most luxurious car, the most lavish trips to Las Vegas.
How often do you think Ed took people to Vegas?
A couple times a month, once a month.
When he was in Vegas, he liked to party. He liked to be around beautiful women. He liked to be at the center of the action. He wanted to be, instead of that sort of squeaky clean nerd in the golf club, he wanted to be the cool guy at the center of the action in Las Vegas.
In 2009, while Chris's business, the 800 Exchange, is taking off, he invites his younger brother, Paul, to come work with him there. Chris is only 2 years older than Paul, but not only have they always been incredibly close, but Paul says that he saw Chris as something of a protector and a supporter. When Chris asked you to come down to Orange County, what was his pitch?
My brother said, you know, we have a successful lead gen company. It's already been up and running for a couple months. We'd like you to come and work for us and be in sales.
We flew down to look at rentals because we wanted to move down there. Once Paul started working for Chris and Ed let us use his car, took us out to lunch, like I held his kids.
He was very charming. He was a religious guy, had a family.
At this point, Ed and Chris are living large, spending a lot of money. It's also at this point that Joe Gray completes his audit and realizes that Ed Shin has been diverting business, embezzling hundreds of thousands of dollars, stealing clients.
How much money do you think Ed Shin embezzled from you?
We think it's about $2.5 million in total.
That's a lot of money.
That is a heartbreaking dollar amount.
At what point did you feel like you understood the totality of Ed Shin's personality?
I think during that week of that Perry Mason forensic audit exercise I went through, I lived it. I lived the betrayal.
Ed was the perfect Jekyll and Hyde.
Joseph Gray extended a helping hand to Ed when he really needed that help. Ed responded by biting the hand that was feeding him.
I had a mandate. My mandate was hold him accountable. Do whatever I had to do to make sure that the district attorney in Riverside County would hold him accountable.
This case won't be that hard to prosecute because they've got records, they've got documents, they've got proof that Shin is skimming money from the company. And he's using it to pay off big gambling debts, high-priced cars and clothes and women. In the end, he's charged in October of 2009 with felony embezzlement.
Chris Smith is realizing day by day that Ed Shin, his partner, is a crook.
He did not care who he hurt or how he hurt people to get what he wanted. With a straight face, he would look you in the eye and be stealing from you. Who does that?
Chris, his senses were on high alert. He wrote his attorney. He said, Ed is itching for a way to commit fraud against me. We've got to keep that from happening.
So just a week after he moved to Laguna to take this job with 800X, Ed's arrested for embezzling from LG.
It was brand new city, new job, and then the boss is arrested. You're like, what?
It was a shock to us, distressing. We just brought our kids down there.
Ed got out immediately. When Paul approached Ed, he kind of smoothed it over like, well, no, it's fine. You don't need to worry about it. It's taken care of.
Chris was shocked by it too. And I asked Chris, you know, if he had anything to do with it. And he said, absolutely not.
The impact of the lawsuit against Ed was really the moment at which the veil was lifted and Chris could see that Ed was just somebody to watch out for.
And this company was making money. I mean, I heard something maybe a few months later, but to the tune of $1 million a month.
The company, yeah, was doing very well. There was a lot of money floating around.
Even in the face of this serious embezzlement case, the company 800 Exchange is still making quite a bit of profit. And that means for Ed continuing his lavish lifestyle, which includes the trips to Las Vegas.
Ed would sometimes bring members of 800 Exchange with him to Las Vegas to talk business and to have some fun.
I saw him at the tables. No one ever knew how much money he was spending. My brother didn't have access to the business accounts.
I remember sitting on the couch with Chris. I said, where are all your financial records? He said, well, Ed handles all that. And I'm like, there should be complete transparency there, especially given his past behavior.
At what point do you really become suspicious of him?
March of 2010, things started to change. I could tell my brother's relationship with Ed had soured a little bit.
Chris started to realize that Ed was someone who couldn't be trusted. He had swindled from his previous company, and it seems that Chris started to wonder, if he did it before, why wouldn't he do it again?
Chris is realizing that he's in business with a con man.
Chris is concerned that Ed is going to steal Chris's rightful share of the 800 exchange, and so he hires a lawyer, Ernesto Aldovar.
Chris came to me and he said, "My partner is a liar, and I'm afraid that he's going to take all the money that we're making. I need your help to see if we can't secure some of my interests."
Ed Shin is convicted of felony embezzlement in May of 2010. And then he reaches an agreement on the sentence. To avoid prison time, he'll pay restitution of roughly $800,000.
And the only way he does not violate his probation and go to state prison is if he comes up with $800,000 that he has to get from 800 Exchange. The only way he can get that out of 800 Exchange is if Chris Smith agrees.
Because Chris Smith is a part owner of the 800 Exchange, Ed needs Chris's signature to free up the funds that Ed is going to need to resolve that settlement deal.
Chris didn't want to sign a settlement because he wanted to make sure that the money that belonged to him was secure. There was a deadline for the settlement to be signed. We knew that it was early the week of June 7th.
Ed was under a lot of pressure from a lot of fronts. He owed $800,000 in a settlement to LG. He allegedly had some big gambling debts in Las Vegas to pay off. He's becoming cornered financially.
So you've got this brewing conflict, and you've got one guy with an attorney trying to do everything right, and then you've got another guy who is completely shady. So it's like two worlds about to collide.
So Chris and Ed met on June 4th, allegedly, to finalize the agreement.
Part of the deal was that Chris would get access to the accounts. And what he expected to see there is millions of dollars just sitting there. That's all the profit that their business had been making over the past year.
The only thing we were waiting for that day is that Chris had to be given access to the bank account so he could see that the money was still there. This is an email from Chris to me dated June 4, 2010 at 12:34 p.m.
"I'm meeting with Ed now to go over statements. He fixed the login. Everything looks normal."
After that, a curious thing happens, which is that Smith's attorney gets an email from Chris Smith with a buyout agreement.
So this is a shift. Instead of providing guarantees that Chris would have access to all the bank accounts, now Chris emails his lawyer telling him that he's selling his share of the company.
This is an email from Chris Smith at 6:01 p.m. It says, "Ernesto, I agreed
in principle with Ed to buy me out. $700,000 of the reserve will be paid in three installments. When Ed sends details, I will forward and we can discuss. Chris."
And then I got this one page resolution. It says, "Both Smith and Shin agreed to execute the settlement in exchange for a good faith payment." My first reaction was, well, why is he doing this? This isn't what we had been negotiating for the past 2 weeks.
When Ernesto Aldovar received that 601 email from Chris, it was a complete game changer. All of a sudden, it's a complete 180 from everything they've been talking about.
The following Monday on June 7th, 2010, I receive an email from Chris that says the documents are still being prepared, but I'm going on vacation for a few weeks to South America, and that let me know if you need anything.
Chris has finalized his settlement with Ed, and he's taken off, unbeknownst to Paul and his family, who've been up in Oregon for the last 2 weeks, so they're completely out of the loop.
Paul and Leah had flown up here to go to my nephew's wedding.
So tell me about this trip. You flew up here to Oregon to visit family, and Chris dropped you off at the airport.
He was, sad that we were leaving, and I gave him a hug. Flew up to Oregon. We were there for a couple weeks. We communicated via text that, he'd be there to pick me up at the Long Beach airport. Just never showed up.
Paul goes on vacation with his family. Chris takes him to the airport. And they're coming back from vacation. Chris isn't there to pick him up. Well, that's kind of odd.
I'm calling and texting. I can't get through to him. And eventually, I get a hold of Ed. And Ed said, oh, yeah, he doesn't have his phone. We came to a settlement. I bought him out of the company. And he took off with some Playboy Playmate to the Galapagos Islands.
You think given how close Chris and Paul were, and the fact that Paul worked and the same company that Paul would have been the first person to know that Chris had just sold his share of the business to Ed Shin. But Chris could sometimes just take off and disappear without notice.
Yeah, I felt it hurt. You know, we were so close to just up and leave and not talk to me about it first. It didn't sit well, but Chris expressed to me that it was such a tremendous amount of stress that he's been put under from Ed in this situation. So when I heard that there was a settlement, I was like, I was in a way happy for him.
Did you worry what it meant for you?
A little bit. That I was there, you know, without him now. So I was a little bit stressed out about it, but I just figured, hey, you know, I have a family here I need to support. I need to be strong, you know, so just carried on as usual.
Not long after he gets back to work, after this massive upheaval in the company, Paul finds there's a new employee, and he's sitting in Chris's office.
Kenny Kraft just showed up all of a sudden in June.
I had just moved back from Hawaii, and I was looking for work at the time, and ended up meeting Ed at a party. Hit it off pretty well. Probably started working there a couple weeks later.
At first, I was like, okay, why is this guy here? What is his role? Why do we need him here? And I was told that he was there just to run errands for Ed.
You came on to try to do sales, and then he tells you, well,
he said, I'd rather have you as an assistant and stay close to me, and Ed decided to bring me on as an assistant chauffeur, sit in the office next door to his and just basically play on the computer until he needed something from me.
I feel like this guy hired you, and for most of the time, you're just sitting there.
Driving to and from, like lunches, driving home, get the kids.
Did you know about Chris at the time?
I had a vague understanding of what had happened. After speaking with Paul, he said it seems perfectly normal that his brother uprooted and took everything with him and went on some crazy adventure surfing.
It's now 2 months after Chris supposedly sold his share of the 800 exchange, and by now, he's been to the Galapagos, around the tip of South America. At some point, he's ditched Tiffany Taylor, and it seems like he's got no intention of ever coming home.
Tuesday, August 31st, 2010. I'm still backpacking through South America and would like to spend more time down here.
There are these emails. It sounds like The Amazing Race or something.
It was more very sporadic, and usually I wrote a lot more emails because I'm missing him. I'm wondering, where are you? I was starting to feel like, I don't know, this is all really fishy here.
I just sent him a question. I said, Chris, what lake do we live on and what type of boat do we have? Just trying to confirm what I knew. Mm-hmm. And it took a while to get the emails back, but he confirmed one. I said, yeah, we live on Kelly Lake.
Considering that one of those answers is a password to an account, what city were you born in? Then I'll tell you about Kelly Lake.
It just kind of solidified for me that he was Chris. Mm-hmm.
The answers give Debbie and Steve Smith some peace of mind. They're reassured, maybe not convinced, but they are feeling better that things are okay and that Chris is having a good time. But then several months go by.
Wednesday, October 20th, 2010. Hey, Mom. I'm in Mumbai, India. I'm headed to Cyprus and Africa after this. I miss you too, but I have so much to see and do.
What began as a one-month trip has now turned into this epic five-month journey.
No credit cards or bank accounts, bro. I'm off the grid forever. I actually was able to use some gold as currency in India. I'm telling you, they use it all the time there. I was able to pay for my boat ride to Cyprus for a half-ounce Kruger.
What an incredible round-the-world trip it sounds like.
It sounded incredible that he was a surfer. He'd be in places like, you know, Hawaii or Tahiti and Costa Rica.
At this point, Chris seems to be going to places that are out of character for him, not places on the globe that would be part of his itinerary. In the meantime, Paul is still working at 800 Exchange. He's got a family to feed, and part of the job includes business trips to Las Vegas.
Ed was gambling most of the time. While we were at the convention, you know, meeting with clients representing 800 Exchange as a company, and there was a big dinner that Ed had planned out for the company employees, and Ed invited women to attend the dinner. I think some of them were Playboy Playmates. While we were there talking business, I happened to see the same girl that I got an image of in an email of the girl that Chris had left with.
This is Tiffany Taylor.
Tiffany Taylor, yeah.
Tiffany Taylor was one of the Atmosphere models hired by Ed Shin. Paul sees Tiffany and his eyes pop out of his skull.
I was very excited to see her because I hadn't talked to anybody that had been with my brother. And so I sat right next to her.
And he says, Tiffany, I thought you were sailing around the world with my brother.
You went to the Galapagos.
How was it?
You left with my brother, right?
Where is he now?
How's Chris?
What's going on?
And she just stared at me like I was crazy.
You've got these two men, they come together, they form this intense friendship, and one of them turns out to be a psychopath, but the other one doesn't find out until it's too late. This is a
crime to remember. Chris Smith is realizing day by day that Ed Shin, his partner, is a crook.
So it seems like Chris Smith just takes off and starts sailing the world, trying to get things right in his head. But his emails to his family start to get weird. Things are just not adding up.
The family is losing their minds because they haven't seen Chris.
There's not a gray area between he's either surfing in South Africa or he's been killed. I think it's kind of one or the other.
Ed, I need you to be honest with me.
Sure.
I need you to tell me the truth about what happened. Show me the truth. Show me the truth. If you made a mistake, now's the time. Own it.
I'm sorry, I just need a second.
He's been leaving wreckage everywhere he's gone. At some point, there must have been a body to remove.
Only a true psychopath could do this.
You're living a double life. You know something that you're not telling.
Picture this scene. There's a business meeting in Las Vegas. Ed is there, Paul Smith is there, and Tiffany Taylor is at this event.
It's Tiffany Taylor, Miss November 1998, Playboy playmate Tiffany, who was supposedly on this sailing trip with Chris. You were sure that you recognized her?
Yes. It's the same exact girl as the picture that I got. And she just looked at me with a blank stare like I was nuts.
Tiffany said, I don't know your brother. I didn't go on any kind of a trip with him. What are you talking about? This is crazy talk.
Then Ed just looks up at me and just goes like this and just shakes his head. After the dinner was over, said, that was the girl that I got a picture of that Chris left with. And he reassured me that that was not the same Tiffany Taylor. It was a different Tiffany Taylor.
Well, think about it. Another Tiffany Taylor? It seems impossible, but also think about Las Vegas. There's no shortage of gorgeous women, probably named Tiffany. And on top of that, Ed is so convincing. The other worrisome thing for Paul is that things are taking a rather dark turn when it comes to 800 Exchange.
There's so much money come in from the clients, and our largest buying partner was not receiving any payments for media. Where was the money going? It was going into Ed's pockets.
It was this feeling of something's wrong, we have to get out.
With Chris gone, Ed's spending a ton of money. He's isolating himself in his office. Ed kind of seems rudderless.
I immediately got an attorney, explained to him what was going on, and he said, put in your resignation via letter. So I did, and just depart quietly.
And so within, I think, 3 days, we packed up the house and we left.
I didn't want to be a part of Ed's world anymore. I knew it was going to get worse.
Hey, Dad. I just finally got to Johannesburg and tried calling Paul internationally. Found a conflict diamond for Paul. Gonna give it to him for his birthday I missed. LOL. CS.
I was like, what are you thinking? Like, you don't need to risk your life to get me a diamond for my birthday.
So remember, Chris has been on this 5-month whirlwind dream trip. In Oregon, his family has been on an emotional roller coaster.
Now, it's during the holidays that the family gets together, and now they're getting really worried. And it's at this point that Paul tells them about this weird incident at the 800 Exchange at just about the time that Chris disappeared.
June 4 was a Friday, and that's the day that Ed and Chris reached this settlement. The following Monday, employees of 800 Exchange get a message from Ed saying, hey, don't come in for the whole week. We got to get the office cleaned.
I went into the office when I wasn't supposed to that week. I needed to grab some stuff, and it smelled really bad, like a rotten stench. There's fans on. It was very damp, like all the carpets were wet. The walls had been painted. And I looked down and I saw a big stain outside of Chris's office on the floor.
And Ed tells everybody Chris was super drunk. He vomited and urinated in his office, and that's the source of the smell.
He didn't drink at the office. I mean, to puke and pee and urinate at the office, I mean, it's totally not normal. You know, he would never do something like that.
I was like, okay, something's really foul here.
That sounded really suspicious to me, because it's not Chris.
Mm-mm.
You're going to go make a $1 million deal, and you're going to get drunk going to it? It made no sense to me at all. So I thought, what the hell?
Chris's father, Steve, was once a cop. But really, once a cop, always a cop. So he has those instincts that tell him something does not smell right. And he realizes it's very possible that Ed Chin may have something to do with the disappearance of his son. Steve sends an email to Chris, but he's thinking in the back of his mind that Ed is really seeing this email. And his hope is to bring him out of the shadow, possibly respond to him so he can get information about his son.
I said to him, Ed Chin, if you hurt any one of my sons, I'm going to up, and this is the start of your nightmare. But then I got a reaction to it.
To Steve Smith, Friday, December 17th, 2010. Dad, I'm fine. Stop tripping. I just needed to get some shit out of my head.
Did that sound like Chris, Daddy Chris tripping? Yeah,
so I thought, okay. But I still have feelings that something was wrong.
December 26th, 2010. To Paul Smith. Just realized it's Christmas. Is it snowing in Bend? It's summer down here with it being so warm. I'm headed back up through the Congo. I'll be offline for a couple weeks. I found a dealer in Rwanda that will pay 30% markup on Krugs because the mint ones are impossible to find.
And so it's just after Christmas that Chris's emails abruptly stop. It's radio silence.
His mom starts to think he fell in with some criminals when they found out he had this gold and he's been murdered somewhere abroad.
I was searching through all the deaths that were happening in Africa and Rwanda and everywhere. And, you know, if anything, it was a Caucasian male, 30 years or so, just searching everywhere.
During the month of December, the family did get a sliver of hope when Chris promises Paul that he'll meet him in Costa Rica in February.
Here's an email I received from Chris. I'll make my way north to Egypt, cross over to Spain, and then head to Costa Rica. Meet me there in February so we can surf and talk about everything. Chris.
In February, Paul and Chris are supposed to go to Costa Rica together. And eventually, Paul calls the hotel that they're actually supposed to go to, and he learns from the hotel that there's no reservation in the name of his brother, that his brother has made no plans to meet up with them. And that really was probably the nail in the coffin, and the family needed to get some help.
Steve Smith went to the State Department, and he very soon hears, this is early in 2011, passport control has no record of your son even leaving this country. As far as we're concerned, he never left.
For the family, this is a stunning revelation. Given all the emails that they've received, how could this possibly be true?
Steve thinks this doesn't make sense because he would need the passport. So now he's got to ask people, well, how would he leave?
And one of the things he did was to go to Ed and ask him what he knew.
I was worried for his safety, though, because I really felt like this guy could probably be really, really dangerous.
When you see that kind of passion and that love for a family member, it's very real. And you could only imagine that long drive from Oregon.
I'd actually brought a gun with me. The main thing I was wanting to do is find my son. Either he knows what happened to Chris or he knows he's responsible for it.
Nine months go by, and the family is losing their minds because they haven't seen Chris. They've gotten these emails, but they have no idea what's actually happened to him. So they decide to begin their own investigation.
I think it was in the spring of 2011. We got to the point where we needed some answers.
I look at Steve as being the rock of that family. He drove all the way down here from Oregon to talk to Ed Chin himself.
I'd actually brought a gun with me. So I left in the car, but I did take a digital recorder to record the conversation.
Hi, how are you doing? Appreciate this.
Yeah, no problem.
We're just getting real nervous. We haven't heard from him in 3 months.
Three.
We're just freaking out that he got killed somewhere, mugged or beat up.
he went on for about an hour's conversation about all kinds of stuff.
I have a feeling I can help you find him if you really want, because the weekend before, we went to Vegas together. Uh-huh. I know he got a fake passport. There was a guy in Vegas who referred Chris to this other guy in L.A. He was the one who got him the passport.
Okay.
Do you believe anything that he's saying to you?
No. I think there's something really wrong. He's lying to me. Either he knows what happened to Chris or he knows he's responsible for it.
The significance of the fake passport story from Ed is either it explains why the State Department has no record of Chris ever leaving the country, or it means that Ed Shin is lying through his teeth, and that is a whole other problem.
After a couple months of doing his own investigation, Steve Smith reported him missing officially to Laguna Beach PD.
They launched their investigation, and in June 2011, a full year after Chris goes missing, Ed comes in for questioning at the Laguna Beach PD.
And he begins describing the story about Chris being drunk and being a flaky guy.
Pissed everywhere. He had broken a couple bottles of wine. It was a mess, and it smelled. So I had to send our employees home because they were complaining about the smell, and we had to get it all cleaned.
When was the last day you saw Chris?
The first Monday of June, I think it was the 3rd or 4th. We went to Las Vegas that weekend.
Okay.
And I dropped him off at home, and that was the last time I saw him. I don't know where he is. I mean, honestly, I think he's the other side of the world. I think he doesn't want to be found.
Thank you. You're yourself, all right?
3 weeks later, Detective Julia Bowman is on the case.
I looked at all of that circumstantial evidence, the timeline of when things happened, listened to Ed Shin's explanation of what had happened in the office, and none of it seemed plausible.
Detective Bowman isn't the only person investigating this case. Enter a gentleman by the name of Joe DeLue. So Joe DeLue is a private investigator, and it's by complete coincidence that he gets involved.
Joe DeLue moves into an office just a couple doors down from the abandoned 800 Exchange.
It's 2011 of April. We were in there for probably just a couple of months, and we were contacted by the property manager. He knew we were a private investigation firm. And he said that one of their tenants, Ed Shin, had skipped out on their lease. The amount that was owed was around $40,000, I believe. He advised us at one point that a local law enforcement agency was trying to get a hold of Ed Shin as well because someone filed a missing persons report on his business partner, Chris Smith. So that kind of perked us up a little bit, too. So I do remember going, would you mind me taking a look at this for you and help find your son.
So we started conversing between us. In a short period of time, we actually became friends.
He eventually sent me the emails and everything that he had, all the things that he did trying to look for his son, and the people that he spoke with, and we just started collecting that and taking a look at it.
The family even hires a computer expert to analyze the data in Chris's emails, trying to figure out where they originated.
He takes a look at him and he says, no, I believe these both came from Wednesday in the United States.
It was a very delicate situation. How do you tell somebody that I think something serious happened to your son that's not just a missing person?
It turns out that the property manager gives Joe DeLue the most incredibly important piece of information. Let's rewind to June of 2010.
Ed calls up the property manager and says, how do you get blood on a carpet?
They then actually send over a porter to look at the blood on the carpet?
The porter goes in there and sees blood. And Ed explains to the porter, oh, I cut my hand when I was cutting an apple.
Joe starts doing some research. As an investigator, he thinks like, hey, maybe we should go look in the office.
We learned that the office was still vacant and we wanted to go take a look.
So the property manager allows you in.
Correct. We're walking around with our flashlight, and that's when we discover some blood, or what we think is blood,
It was very surprising that anything could be found at the office. It had been a year since he had left that office. We heard from Ed Shin himself that he had cleaned the office twice.
So I contacted Don Vogt in Orange County Sheriff's Department.
And he said he thought maybe there was a murder had occurred in there. I kind of explained to Jill that kind of a stretch at this point.
So we went to the office park with the Orange County Crime Lab. They closed the door, and they had sprayed luminol all over the inside of Chris's office, which would present any type of blood that was in the office, and it almost makes it like a fluorescent green color, and it lights up like a Christmas tree.
So we know this isn't just someone cut their finger. No, there's a crime scene here.
We started coming into Chris's office.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things we first picked up on was the blood on the door jamb.
We came into the office, and I pointed out this possible blood drops to the crime lab.
And they sprayed luminol. They found there were blood stains, and they were everywhere. They were on the door frame. They were on the light switch. They were on the floor. They were on the wall. They were on the ceiling.
Just helter-skelter. We had obtained a DNA sample of Christmas parents. Their DNA matched the blood DNA that was found at the scene. But that's when we realized all this blood in the crime scene does belong to Chris Smith. We knew at this point that we were going to arrest Ed Shin for the murder of Chris Smith. On August 28th, we found out that Ed Shin had boarded a plane at LAX and he was headed to Canada.
So I gave the green light, rip him off the plane, and we're going to hook him at this point.
We technically arrested him for violating his probation because Ed Shin had been arrested in Riverside County for embezzling. He's not allowed to leave the country. So we arrested him and brought him back.
Of course, the sheriff's had a wealth of information that he didn't know that they knew.
We got him talking. We started talking about Chris Smith.
He went missing in June, and they didn't talk to you until...
No. He left the country in June. I think he went missing in, like, December.
Orange County homicide investigators Don Vogt and Ray Wirt spend hours questioning Ed Shin. And Ed sticks to that same story, that Chris sold his shares of the 800 Exchange and just vanished out into the Pacific somewhere.
We ultimately decided we're going to confront him with the evidence that we have.
There's blood on the walls, there's blood on the doorway, okay? It's a scientific fact. Okay. I'm not making it up. And we know it's Chris's blood.
Okay.
And we gave him an opportunity to tell us his story. And Ed's response to us was, I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't kill Chris.
What I want to say is I want an attorney.
Ed asked for a lawyer. And so the interrogation is immediately ended. And then half an hour later.
You want to talk again?
Investigators Vogt and Wirt are told he actually wants to come back and set the record straight.
Ed went on to tell us, I didn't murder Chris Smith, but him and Chris had been involved in this knockdown, drag out fight.
Somehow he was able to grab me and he kind of picked me up and had the momentum to like throw me across his desk. I jumped up and he jumped up on the desk and we kind of like almost like two rams collided on his desk, and you know, that's probably where the blood got on the ceiling. I was able to position myself to where I was charging him into his office again, and literally that's when I think his head hit the desk, and he was unconscious. I mean, there's blood all over his office, pool of blood from coming from his head.
It's during this interrogation that all of these revelations just start spilling out. Ed now says, this wasn't murder, this was self-defense. We had a fight, and Chris just died. And all of those emails to the family, all of them were Ed's imagination. Even those cruel emails breaking up with his girlfriend, Erica, that was all Ed Shin's doing.
Chris had not been sailing the world with an exotic Playboy playmate. Chris had not been visiting Rwanda and Chile and Ecuador. These emails had all been written by Edward Shin using Chris's email accounts. It was all a charade.
It's utterly ruthless. You know, it is fundamentally awful what he's doing here. Only a true psychopath could do this.
and they charged him with first-degree murder.
Good morning, America. Breaking news.
A bizarre and extremely cruel murder and cover-up. Police say a California man killed his business partner, then covered his tracks by creating a virtual life online.
Once they confirmed that Chris Smith is actually dead, one of the most brutal, difficult things in law enforcement is making that call to the family, and they had to do that.
It was awful. It's like even gutted. It's just like a horrible nightmare, and we're living this out. It's just like horrible.
We drove over to Paul's house, and when we got there, he was out in the driveway crying.
It was a tough day. Just fell to my knees. It was tough. The images that come into your mind at that point of someone you love being murdered brought in a lot of emotions. Just heartbreak.
It's hard to see how much it hurt Paul because they were like twins.
So there's nothing to help the family that you can give us right now to indicate where Chris's body might be for closure for the family.
I understand. No, I don't have anything.
Shin claims he gets in contact with a Russian man whom he pays $10,000 to $15,000 to dispose of the body. The next morning, Chris's body is gone, and Ed claims he has no idea where it is.
And so Monday came around, I got back to the office, he's gone.
The reason the office smelled so bad, despite all of Ed Shin's stories about Chris throwing up, the real reason it stank is because underneath those carpets is decaying human tissue in the form of Chris's blood.
He won't say where the body is because he would then have to show the cause of death, which would absolutely prove that it wasn't mutual combat.
Detective Bowman analyzes all of Ed Shin's cell phone records and these cell phone tower pings, and she finds that on two occasions, June 7th and June 9th, Ed drives 170 miles into the desert near this town called Boulevard, California, which is this desolate desert area right up against the Mexican border.
There's no reason for Ed Shin to have driven in the middle of the night and sat there for 2 hours unless he's dumping the body of Chris Smith.
After we got those cell phone pings, they had helicopters and ATVs and dogs, and they had 80 people looking for him. And, you know, the problem is that so much time had gone by.
There's no body.
No body.
There's no murder weapon.
No murder weapon. It's very challenging to try somebody for murder without the body, right? Because the body will tell you everything.
You see the Smith family out there, right?
Last chance, Mr. Shin. Show us where the body is.
Superior Court of the State of California, and for the County of Orange is now in session. Capital Greg L. Trickett, Judge presiding. Please be seated.
This trial took a long time to get underway.
Yeah. You're just in this suspended reality of not having closure and answers. You just get stuck. I had a lot of rage. It just felt like a storm.
So if you had to boil this case down into the simplest terms, how would you characterize it?
Ruthless, diabolical greed to the extreme. I mean, that's really what this boils down to.
This is now 7 years later that he's going to trial. So for the Smith family, this has just been painful waiting. And now finally, in 2018, Ed Shin is finally standing trial. He's charged with first-degree murder with special circumstances. Special circumstance being it was for financial gain. If convicted under California law, you get a mandatory sentence of life without parole.
Ladies and gentlemen, the evidence is going to show that in trying to legally protect his own financial interests, Chris Smith became an obstacle for Ed Shin.
Ed Shin was in a corner. Chris Smith had him in a corner. The way he could solve his problems financially, business-wise, everything else, is murder Chris Smith, make him disappear, and take all of his money.
The evidence is going to show, ladies and gentlemen, that Chris Smith's office on June 4th in the evening hours, it was helter-skelter in there. There's blood on the ceiling, there's blood on the carpet, there's blood on the walls, there's blood on the furniture. The evidence is going to show that man there beat or stabbed Chris Smith brutally to death in that office.
Matt Murphy's going to argue this was a premeditated murder. The key piece of evidence is the timing of one email sent by Ed Shin, pretending to be Chris Smith, to Chris's attorney on the night of the alleged murder.
At 6:01 that night, did you receive an email concerning what appeared to be a change in heart or change in direction from Mr. Smith concerning the future of these companies?
Yes.
So that's our window where we know the murder had to take place. That email, it's perfectly written. It's not done in a panic. It makes sense. It has the right tone. And it's attached to an exhibit with a fake signature on it. So there's virtually no way Ed Shin showed up in that office without that email and that attachment ready to roll. And that means he's already decided he's going to kill him.
You solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give in the cause now pending before this court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help you God.
I do.
According to Ed Shin, Chris Smith was responsible for everything.
He lunged at me again, and I think at that point, I felt I had to fight back. I don't know if I threw him or if I shoved him, but somehow I pushed him into this area, and that's when he fell and he hit the desk really hard.
It's always risky for a defendant to take the witness stand because the entire case then comes down to, do the jurors believe Ed Shin? Every single word, every facial expression, every motion becomes critical.
So how is it, Mr. Shin, you didn't have a bruise or you didn't bleed somewhere? Can you explain that for us?
I cannot.
Okay.
There you are. He's on the floor of the office. He's just sustained a significant physical injury. And you can dial 911 and they can come save him. So if you didn't want him to die, why didn't you dial 911, Mr. Shin? So I was in shock. You didn't dial 911 because you knew that if he died, you got his money. Isn't that true? No.
This is murder that's repeated itself throughout history. You got one guy who wants something from another guy, and the way to get it, if you won't agree, is kill him and take it.
Then there was this moment during cross-examination in which Ed Shin looked like he was about to cry. He was kind of shedding a tear.
Are you tearing up a little bit right now? I'm okay, sir.
Was he feeling sorry for himself? Whatever it was, Matt Murphy saw that and went in for the kill.
Were you tearing up when you wrote that email to Debbie Smith saying their son was committing suicide or suggesting that he was going to do that? Were you tearing up when you did that?
Yes.
Okay. You were actually at the computer tearing up as you were going to break a mother's heart by essentially blaming her for the death of her son. That was making you feel sad?
It was one of the many emotions I felt, yes.
That was 100% con. That was manipulator par excellence trying to work my jury. He's trying to make the jury feel sorry for him after all the destruction that he's caused. There's no getting emotional when you're a ruthless killer like that.
In front of the jury, Ed Shin does not budge from his claim that this was all self-defense. As for the body, well, Ed Shin has an answer for that as well. He claims he hired a Russian to dispose of the body.
I've always believed he drove him out to the desert and he dumped him.
You're familiar with the phrase, the truth will set you free?
Yes.
So here we've got a skull somewhere out there in the world right now that if your story is true, it's going to match what you say. There's going to be a single impact wound in the back of the skull that looks like a corner of a desk, right?
Yes. Ed Shin says Chris fell down in the middle of this fight and hit his head. And he died from that. That means he's going to have a skull fracture that indicates a single blunt force trauma, and he's going to be able to prove what he said. So why doesn't Ed Shin set himself free by telling us where the body is? Because it's complete nonsense. It's not true. That skull has multiple blunt force trauma, and that's why Ed didn't give it up.
The jury gets the case on December 7th, 2018, and it takes them less than an hour to reach a verdict.
Peace, if you would please read the verdict.
We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant, Edward Younghoon Shin, guilty of the crime of felony to it, violation of section one.
My feeling when the verdict was read is total relief that he's going to be somewhere where he can't hurt anybody else again.
The verdict came down the same day that we interviewed Joe Gray, and so we were there with him as he broke the news to his wife, Patty.
They got him for first-degree murder. That's should be, sentencing should be life in prison.
Oh, my God. No.
He won't be hurting anyone else, babe.
Thank God.
We're actually inside the Olasi facility, and we're about to interview Ed Shin 16 hours after sentencing. Are you afraid that this mysterious Russian that you've spoken about is going to come after you? Or are you just keeping this piece of information as a bargaining chip?
National Geographic.
Nine years after he murdered Chris Smith, and about 8 months after a jury took less than an hour to find him guilty of first-degree murder with special circumstances, Ed Shin is back in court with the same judge about to learn his fate.
After we get the verdict, you have a sentencing, and each family has an opportunity to either address the court or to have an advocate address the court. Shin's mom, Mrs. Shin, her statement was very emotional, and she tried to take all the blame.
Your Honor, my name is Jennifer Shin, mother of Edward Shin. Please know how sorry I am to both the Smith family and to this court. This is my fault. After college, Edward wants to be a pastor so he could lead children's ministry. I know he wouldn't be here today if I didn't ask him to change his decision. Please mercy my son. Thank you, Honor.
You know, and I felt sorry for his mom, who's in court every day, but she knows what, you know, what his background is.
Ed not only ruined our family, but he ruined his own family and his mom and dad's family.
Just a lot of loss.
Even in a wrongful conviction, if I don't ask this court to show me no mercy, I must bear the responsibility of doing so many awful things, and if it means a life of physical suffering, so be it. God put me on this earth to serve him and gave me every opportunity and talent to tend to a sheep. Instead, I chose the path of a wolf.
The court will sentence the defendant then to life without possibility of parole.
He's been leaving wreckage everywhere he's gone.
It's like a boat going through the water, and instead of a wake of water, it's a wake of destroyed or ruined lives everywhere he goes.
We're actually inside the Olasi facility, and we're about to interview Ed Shin 16 hours after the sentencing. The primary question everybody wants to know, where is Chris's body?
How are you doing?
A small part of me is relieved because there's some closure now.
In court yesterday, you described going down the path of the wolf. When did you begin to choose the path of the wolf?
Well, you know, my first job out of college was as a stockbroker. So I'm being conditioned, especially as a young professional, that it's all about the money. You know, Gordon Gekko from Wall Street.
Greed, for lack of a better word, is good.
But there is a difference between greed and crime.
Absolutely.
And you cross that line between greed and theft.
Because you're making so much money, and then the money's fast, quick. That's addicting.
It seemed that you were living a double life. You were this father at home in California.
But in Vegas, you were gambling a lot of money, seeing hookers, doing other things. Safe to say that that's true?
Yeah.
Basically, the money you were supposed to use to pay back Joe Gray, you were sending to the casino.
Yes, I did that on a few occasions.
June 4th, 2010, Chris Smith wants access to the books. Why did you kill him?
We got in a fight.
There are fights, and then there's killing someone.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to kill him.
Why'd you finish him off?
Finish him off?
You could have called 911.
I was in total panic. What are you supposed to do at that point?
You could have said, hey, the guy rushed me, he attacked me. I had no choice but to defend myself, he fell.
I was already in a criminal case. You know, had that not been active, I probably would have called 911. But no one's ever gonna believe me. These cops aren't gonna believe me.
So you have this dead body on the floor. What do you do with it?
Me, personally, I didn't do anything.
And so who was the person?
I can't talk about that right now.
Ed, you're facing the rest of your life in prison.
I am.
You are going to spend the rest of your life in prison, it seems, if there's no appeal.
And I'm here against, you know, the advice of my attorney, so.
And now you're holding the location of his body.
I'm not holding
over on his parents.
I don't know it.
But you know the person who can get it. You've admitted to the worst of this, right? You've admitted to stealing. You've admitted to killing Chris Smith.
Right.
You've admitted to writing the emails.
Right.
You hacked into his life. You broke up with his girlfriend, and you told his parents that he was traveling across the world, and then that he was suicidal.
Yeah, that was kind of like, perhaps, you know, that was the exit strategy, but I couldn't go through with it, you know?
Because you had to find a way to kill off Chris, at least the email version of him.
That was a potential exit strategy, yes, but I couldn't go through with it. You know, there was still that little last shred of, I guess, morality or whatever you want that prevented me from doing it.
I mean, in some ways, it seems like you killed him twice.
In some ways, yeah.
In the sentencing yesterday, you said, I hope that someday I'll be given the opportunity to help locate Chris's body. That gives the indication that you know something that you're not telling. That you know where it is.
No.
Now you're holding the location of his body.
I'm not holding
over
it,
on his
because I don't know it.
But you know the person who can get it.
But that's just not, doesn't, there's no way I can get to that at this point. And there's no way that I'm gonna do it. I'm sorry, I wish I could tell you more, but it's something bigger that I just can't talk about.
Maybe it's a bargaining chip for the future, although
no.
One would think
there,
you would have used
there
it.
There is no, it's not. You know, you have to think about it. If someone's willing to give up his life to protect a secret, there's a reason, right?
Okay.
He knows exactly what happened to Chris because he killed him, and he knows exactly where the body is because he took the body out there and buried him. So Ed Shin is a liar. Of course he's not gonna cough up where the body is, but we'll find it eventually. We will find it eventually.
Tell me about that pad aloud.
That was for all of his friends, and they needed to remember him.
A pad aloud, it's a part of surfing culture. After Chris died, about 25 of his good friends and Paul did what's called a paddle out. It's like a funeral service almost. It's a memorial that surfers have for other surfers.
They brought their boards and they made the reef. The sea was flat except for the dolphins and birds out there. And all they went out and did the paddle out. It was beautiful.
Chris, how you doing?
At his memorial service, I found a song by Jars of Clay that we played, and it talks about, it doesn't matter where my body lays.
It don't matter where I lay. All my tears be washed away.
And so it's just such a prophetic song, you know, to what's turned out, so we don't have anything. No body, but we know where he is.
Yeah.
And we'll see him again. We can feel his spirit still. We're confident that we're going to see him again someday. You know, we have that hope. So we cling to that hope.
But it's an odd feeling, because if you've had a child, the child has grown inside of you, it feels like part of you is somewhere out in the desert, and it feels strange. There's a part of you, you know, that is us, is out lying in the desert.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia, Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.